Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Katie Weaver, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
The pirate known as Blackbeard terrorized the Atlantic coast of North America in the early 1700s. In a few months, the United States Supreme Court will hear a case related to Blackbeard's ship. The case involves a filmmaker who claims the rights to images of the ship belong to him, not the state of North Carolina. Here is what happened. Back in 1718, Blackbeard was sailing a ship named the Queen Anne's Revenge, after a former Queen of England. One day, the Queen Anne's Revenge and a smaller ship went into a harbor now known as Beaufort Inlet in North Carolina. The water was not very deep, and the ships ran into the sand. Blackbeard may have grounded the ships on purpose, but that is another story. Blackbeard abandoned the Queen Anne's Revenge, along with a number of its crew members. He and a few of his favorite pirates escaped with valuable treasure. A few months later, Blackbeard was killed by British forces, and in time, the Queen Anne's Revenge disappeared under the water. In U.S. law, the sunken ship and everything on it belongs to the state of North Carolina. Jump to the year 1996. A private company found the remains of the Queen Anne's Revenge. The company used divers and archaeologists to explore the wreckage and bring the artifacts to the surface. A media company, Nautilus Productions, took pictures and videos of the recovery effort. The co-owner of the media company, Frederick Allen, received federal copyright protection over the images. In other words, U.S. national law says no one can use the images without getting the company's permission and paying Nautilus. Yet, North Carolina state officials used some of the images on YouTube and a state agency website without permission. Some would claim the officials pirated them. The state government also passed a law to make some of the images into public records, free for anyone to use. In answer, Nautilus co-owner Frederick Allen brought legal action against the state of North Carolina. At issue is whether states must pay damages for copyright violations. Historically, the U.S. Constitution and some earlier court cases have protected states against lawsuits. But in 1990, the U.S. Congress passed a law allowing states to be sued for illegal copying. A lower court said the 1990 law is not constitutional. Congress did not have the power to make such a law, the lower court said. As a result, a judge dismissed Allen's case. So now, Allen is taking his argument to the U.S. Supreme Court. He says states are breaking federal law and then refusing to pay damages for their violations. He also says, people who create original work need a way to object when states ignore copyright laws. The Supreme Court has agreed only to hear the case. The justices will likely make a ruling on it next year. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
At a Dalcom coffee shop in Seoul, a robot takes your order through a mobile app or a touchscreen and then makes fresh coffee. The robot can make up to 14 drinks at a time. Che Eun-jin thinks the process is fun and easy. The 30-year-old office worker said, the area is crowded with office workers and local residents during lunchtime, so it's good to have a robot like this, so you can get your coffee more easily. Coffee is just one of the many industries that use automated services in this technologically forward-thinking nation. Others include restaurants, food stores, banks, and manufacturers. The development comes as many Koreans, especially the young, are struggling to find work. Just this week, workers who operate about 2,500 large cranes at building sites went on strike. They were protesting the growing use of robotic small cranes for building. Other labor unions also have protested about the use of automated devices instead of human workers at E-Mart, South Korea's biggest food store group. South Korean officials also changed plans to completely automate the nation's road fee collection system. They acted after receiving criticism for cutting 6,700 jobs. Instead, the system will be partly automated and keep all its current human fee collectors. South Korea has been an early adopter of automation. It had the highest percentage of robots to human workers in the world in 2017. The International Federation of Robotics says South Korea has 710 robots for every 10,000 manufacturing workers. The international average is 85 robots per 10,000 employees. South Korea's lowest permitted worker wage has increased by 27.3% over the last 2 years. This has led more businesses to cut labor costs by using automation, says Seo Young-ju of the business school at Sukmyung Women's University in Seoul. Even with the job losses, South Korea's businesses are replacing employees with automation, and young people are welcoming the change. Suh said, currently, millennials, those who were born after 1980, are prime consumers. This generation tends to not like meeting other people, so they favor technology that enables people to minimize face-to-face interactions. I'm Katie Weaver.
The first U.S. astronauts chosen to fly on a private spaceship to the International Space Station, or ISS, are preparing for the planned trip later this year. The two astronauts, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, recently spoke with the Reuters news agency in Houston, Texas. They met at the Lyndon B. Johnson Space Agency, where NASA, the United States Space Agency, trains astronauts for spaceflight. Behnken and Hurley spoke about their preparations and recent tests of the spacecraft that will carry them to space. The two men will fly on the Crew Dragon spacecraft, which was built by private American company SpaceX. In March, the Crew Dragon completed a successful 6-day unmanned test mission to the ISS. The spacecraft returned safely to Earth, landing in the Atlantic Ocean, and was recovered several days later. But during a ground test carried out on April 20th, the same Crew Dragon capsule exploded. The test involved a system designed to propel the spacecraft and its crew to safety in the event of a launch failure. SpaceX is leading the investigation into the April accident. The company has called the explosion an anomaly. Behnken and Hurley both flew on NASA's space shuttles. They told Reuters the test failure represents part of the process. They noted that the Crew Dragon technology is far more developed than what was used in the space shuttle program, which ended 8 years ago. The two Americans are set to travel on the first manned Crew Dragon flight to the ISS later this year. The rocket will be launched from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Some experts believe the accident investigation and design delays may push the launch into 2020. But the astronauts say they have trust in the abilities of the space vehicles being developed in partnerships between NASA and private companies. They also said the business of space flight was not always well-ordered or clean. People, to a degree, think it's pretty glamorous to be able to go into space, but it's actually like a messy camping trip, Hurley told Reuters. Behnken said the astronauts have received valuable information from SpaceX about the investigation of the accident. In general, the anomaly that happened to us in the past, that's the best kind because we'll figure that one out. And we'll make sure that that's not going to happen again, he said. We're the risk takers, and being informed on that risk is super important as well. Mike Hopkins is another astronaut who was chosen for a later mission aboard the Crew Dragon with astronaut Victor Glover. Hopkins spoke about the latest difficulties in the ground tests. This is part of the process. It's not surprising that it's happened, he said. We all wish that we haven't had some of these issues, but as long as you've got a good process, a good team put together, you can get through them. The Crew Dragon and the Falcon 9 rocket that carry it into Earth's orbit are both SpaceX creations. The first successful crewed launch will mark a major step forward in NASA's plans to use private companies to fuel future space travel. The space agency is paying SpaceX and U.S.-based Boeing a total of $6.8 billion to build competing rocket and capsule systems to send astronauts into space. Since NASA ended its space shuttle program in 2011, U.S. astronauts have used Russian-launched spacecraft to get to the ISS. Boeing plans to launch its Starliner capsule without a crew sometime this year, followed by a later mission with astronauts. The Starliner is designed to return to Earth on land, not sea. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 33rd president, Harry Truman. Truman was sometimes called an accidental president. He only became president because he was vice president when Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945. In the election of 1948, Truman ran for a full term. As we told you last week, many experts predicted he would lose. But voters chose him over the Republican Party candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, the governor of New York. Americans also elected a Congress with a majority from Truman's Democratic Party. The president might have expected a Congress led by his own party to support his policies, but that did not always happen. Time after time, Democrats from southern states joined in voting with conservative Republicans. Together, these lawmakers defeated some of Truman's most important proposals. One of the defeated bills was a proposal for health care insurance for every American. One of the major issues during Truman's second term was fear of communism. After World War II, Americans watched as one Eastern European nation after another became an ally of the Soviet Union. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin wanted to see communism spread around the world. And Americans watched as China became communist in 1949, as forces led by Mao Zedong defeated the Chinese nationalists after a civil war that had lasted more than 10 years. During this tense period, there were charges that communists held important jobs in the United States government. These fears, real or imagined, became known as the Red Scare.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
A Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, led the search for communists in America. In speeches and congressional hearings, he accused hundreds of people of being communists or communist supporters. His targets included the State Department, the Army, and the entertainment industry. Senator McCarthy often had little evidence to support his accusations. Many of his charges would not have been accepted in a court of law. But the rules governing congressional hearings were different, so he was able to make his accusations freely. Many people lost their jobs after they were denounced as communists. Some had to use false names to get work. A few went to jail briefly for refusing to cooperate with McCarthy. The senator continued his anti-communist investigations for several years. By the early 1950s, however, more people began to question his methods. Critics said he violated democratic traditions. In 1954, the Senate finally voted to condemn his actions. McCarthy died 3 years later. There were problems caused by the fear of communists at home. But President Truman also had to deal with the threat of communism in other countries. He agreed to send American aid to Greece and Turkey. He also supported continuing the Marshall Plan. That was the huge economic aid program that helped rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Many historians say the Marshall Plan prevented Western Europe from becoming communist. The defense of Western Europe against Soviet communism led Truman to support the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO began in 1949 with the United States, Britain, Canada, France, and eight other nations. The treaty that created NATO stated that a military attack on any member would be considered an attack on all of them. Truman named General Dwight Eisenhower to command the new organization. General Eisenhower had been supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe in World War II. In his swearing-in speech in 1949, Truman urged the United States to lend money to other countries to aid their development. He also wanted to share American science and technology. In 1951, the president asked Congress to establish a new foreign aid program. The aid would go to countries threatened by communist forces in Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, East Asia, South Asia, and Latin America. Truman believed the United States would be stronger if its allies were stronger. President Truman believed that many of the world's problems could be settled by means other than military force. But he supported and used military power throughout his presidency. On June 25, 1950, forces from North Korea invaded South Korea. 2 days later, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution urging UN members to help South Korea resist the invasion. At first, President Truman agreed to send American planes and ships. Later, he agreed to send American ground forces. The president knew his decision could start World War III if the Soviet Union entered the war on the side of communist North Korea. Yet he felt the United States had to act. Later, he said it was the most difficult decision he made as president. Truman named Army General Douglas MacArthur to command all United Nations forces in South Korea. Most of the fighting in the Korean War took place along the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. This line formed the border between North and South Korea. Many victories on the battlefield were only temporary. One side would capture a hill, then the other side would recapture it. In September of 1950, MacArthur led the UN land and sea attack at Incheon, pushing the North Koreans back across the border. There was hope that the war could end by Christmas, December 25th. In late November, however, troops from China joined the North Koreans. Thousands of Chinese soldiers helped push the UN troops south. General MacArthur wanted to attack Chinese bases in Manchuria. President Truman said no. He did not want the fighting to spread beyond the Korean Peninsula. Again, he feared that such a decision could start another world war. MacArthur strongly believed he could end the war quickly by extending it to the Chinese mainland. He publicly denounced Truman's policy, saying, "There is no substitute for victory." Truman felt that the general left him no choice. In April of 1951, he dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In the United States, military leaders are expected to obey their commander-in-chief, the president. While some Americans approved of the general's dismissal, many others supported MacArthur. Millions greeted him when he returned to the United States. There were huge parades in his honor in San Francisco and New York. In fact, few leaders in the 20th century could boast the support MacArthur had. Almost 7 million people attended the ticker tape parade given to him by New York City. And that almost doubled the size of the one given to another returning World War II hero, General Dwight Eisenhower. MacArthur gave his farewell speech to a joint session of Congress on April 19, 1951.
"I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye."
On the Korean Peninsula, the war continued. Ceasefire talks began in July of 1951, but the conflict would last for another 2 years until a truce was declared. The Korean War Armistice Agreement was signed on July 27, 1953.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.